The Mystery of the Blue Train, Agatha Christie, Chapter 14, Ada Mason's Story. I cannot repeat to you often enough, monsieur, our horror, our consternation, and the deep sympathy we feel for you. Thus, Monsieur Carrège, the juge d'instruction, addressed Van Alden. Monsieur Coe, the commissary, made sympathetic noises in his throat. Van Alden brushed away horror, consternation, and sympathy with an abrupt gesture. The scene was the examining magistrate's room at Nice. Besides Monsieur Carrège, the commissary, and Van Alden, there was a further person in the room. It was that person who now spoke. Monsieur Van Alden, he said, desires action, swift action. Ah, cried the commissary. I have not yet presented you, Monsieur Van Alden. This is Monsieur Hercule Poirot. You have doubtless heard of him. Although he has retired from his profession for some years now, his name is still a household word as one of the greatest living detectives. Pleased to meet you, Monsieur Poirot, said Van Alden, falling back mechanically on a formula that he had discarded some years ago. You have retired from your profession? That is so, monsieur. Now I enjoy the world. The little man made a grandiloquent gesture. Monsieur Poirot happened to be traveling on the blue train, explained the commissary, and he has been so kind as to assist us out of his vast experience. The millionaire looked at Poirot keenly. Then he said unexpectedly, I'm a very rich man, Monsieur Poirot. It's usually said that a rich man labors under the belief that he can buy everything and everyone. That is not true. I'm a big man in my way, and one big man can ask a favor from another big man. Poirot nodded a quick appreciation. That is very well said, Monsieur Van Alden. I place myself entirely at your service. Thank you, said Van Alden. I can only say call upon me at any time, and you will not find me ungrateful. And now, gentlemen, to business. I propose, said Monsieur Carrège, to interrogate the maid, Ada Mason. You have her here, I understand. Yes, said Van Alden. We picked her up in Paris in passing through. She was very upset to hear of her mistress's death, but she tells her story coherently enough. We will have her in, then, said Monsieur Carrège. He rang the bell on his desk, and in a few minutes, Ada Mason entered the room. She was very neatly dressed in black, and the tip of her nose was red. She had exchanged her gray traveling gloves for a pair of black suede shoes. She cast a look round the examining magistrate's office in some trepidation, and seemed relieved at the presence of her mistress's father. The examining magistrate prided himself on his geniality of manner, and did his best to put her at her ease. He was helped in this by Poirot, who acted as interpreter, and whose friendly manner was reassuring to the Englishwoman. Your name is Ada Mason, is that right? Ada Beatrice, I was christened, sir, said Mason primly. Just so. And we can understand, Mason, that this has all been very distressing. Oh, indeed it has, sir. I've been with many ladies and always given satisfaction, I hope, and I never dreamt of anything of this kind happening in any situation where I was. No, no, said Monsieur Carrège. Naturally, I've read of such things, of course, in the Sunday papers, and then I've always understood that those foreign trains... She suddenly checked her flow, remembering that the gentlemen who were speaking to her were of the same nationality as the trains. Now let us talk this affair over, said Monsieur Carrège. There was, I understand, no question of your staying in Paris when you started from London. Oh, no, sir. We were to go straight through to Nice. Have you ever been abroad with your mistress before? No, sir. I had only been with her 2 months, you see. Did she seem quite as usual when starting the journey? She was worried-like and a bit upset, and she was rather irritable and difficult to please. Monsieur Carrège nodded. Now then, Mason, what was the first you heard of your stopping in Paris? It was at the place they call the Gare de Lyon, sir. My mistress was thinking of getting out and walking up and down the platform. She was just going out into the corridor when she gave me a sudden exclamation and came back into her compartment with the gentleman. She shut the door between her carriage and mine so that I didn't see or hear anything, till she suddenly opened it again and told me that she had changed her plans. She gave me some money and told me to get out and go to the Ritz. They knew her well there, she said, and would give me a room. I was to wait there until I heard from her. She would wire me what she wanted me to do. I had just time to get my things together and jump out of the train before it started off. It was a rush. While Mrs. Kettering was telling you this, where was the gentleman? He was standing in the other compartment, sir, looking out the window. Can you describe him to us? Well, you see, sir, I hardly saw him. He had his back to me most of the time. He was a tall gentleman, and dark, that's all I can say. He was dressed very like another gentleman in a dark blue overcoat and a gray hat. Was he one of the passengers on the train? I don't think so, sir. I took it that he'd come to the station to see Mrs. Kettering in passing through. Of course, he might have been one of the passengers. I never thought of that. Mason seemed a little flurried by the suggestion. Ah, Monsieur Carrège passed lightly to another subject. Your mistress later requested the conductor not to rouse her early in the morning. Was that a likely thing for her to do, do you think? Oh, yes, sir. The mistress never ate any breakfast, and she didn't sleep well at nights, so that she liked sleeping on in the morning. Again, Monsieur Carrège passed to another subject. Amongst the luggage, there was a scarlet Morocco case, was there not? He asked. Your mistress's jewel case? Yes, sir. Did you take that case to the Ritz? Me? Take the mistress's jewel case to the Ritz? Oh, no, indeed, sir. Mason's tones were horrified. You left it behind you in the carriage? Yes, sir. Had your mistress many jewels with her, do you know? A fair amount, sir. Made me a bit uneasy sometimes, I can tell you, with those nasty tales you hear being robbed in foreign countries. They were insured, I know, but all the same, it seemed a frightful risk. Why, the rubies alone, the mistress told me, were worth several hundred thousand pounds. The rubies? What rubies? Barked Van Alden suddenly. Mason turned to him. I think it was you who gave them to her, sir, not very long ago. My God, cried Van Alden. You don't say that she had those rubies with her. I told her to leave them at the bank. Mason gave once more the discreet cough, which was apparently part of her stock in trade as a lady's maid. This time it expressed a good deal. It expressed far more clearly than words could have done that Mason's mistress had been a lady who took her own way. Ruth must have been mad, muttered Van Alden. What on earth could have possessed her? Monsieur Carrège, in turn, gave vent to a cough, again a cough of significance. It riveted Van Alden's attention on him. For the moment, said Monsieur Carrège, addressing Mason, I think that is all. If you will go into the next room, mademoiselle, they'll read over to you the question and answers, and you will sign accordingly. Mason went out escorted by the clerk, and Van Alden said immediately to the magistrate, Well? Monsieur Carrège opened a drawer in his desk, took out a letter, and handed it across to Van Alden. This was found in Madame's handbag. Cher ami, the letter ran, I will obey you. I will be prudent, discreet, all those things that a lover most hates. Paris would perhaps have been unwise, but the Îles d'Or are far away from the world, and you may be assured that nothing will leak out. It is like you and your divine sympathy to be so interested in the work on famous jewels that I'm writing. It will indeed be an extraordinary privilege to actually see and handle these historic rubies. I'm devoting a special passage to Heart of Fire. My wonderful one, soon I will make up to you for all those sad years of separation and emptiness. Your ever adoring Armand. Chapter 15. The Comte de la Roche. Van Alden read the letter through in silence. His face turned a dull, angry crimson. The men watching him saw the veins start out on his forehead and his big hands clench themselves unconsciously. He handed back the letter without a word. Monsieur Carrège was looking with close attention at his desk. Monsieur Coe's eyes were fixed upon the ceiling, and Monsieur Hercule Poirot was tenderly brushing a speck of dust from his coat sleeve. With the greatest tact, they none of them looked at Fanaldin. It was Monsieur Carrège, mindful of his status and his duties, who tackled the unpleasant subject. "Perhaps, monsieur," he murmured, "you are aware by whom this letter was written?" "Yes, I know," said Fanaldin heavily.
"Ah," said the magistrate inquiringly.
"A scoundrel who calls himself the Comte de la Roche." There was a pause. Then Monsieur Poirot leaned forward, straightened a ruler on the judge's desk, and addressed the millionaire directly. "Monsieur Fanaldin, we are all sensible, deeply sensible, of the pain it must give you to speak of these matters. But believe me, monsieur, it is not the time for concealments. If justice is to be done, we must know everything. If you will reflect a little minute, you'll realize the truth of that, clearly, for yourself." Fanaldin was silent for a moment or two. Then, almost reluctantly, he nodded his head in agreement. "You're quite right, Monsieur Poirot," he said. "Painful as it is, I have no right to keep anything back." The commissary gave a sigh of relief, and the examining magistrate leaned back in his chair and adjusted a pince-nez on his long, thin nose. "Perhaps you'll tell us in your own words, Monsieur Fanaldin," he said, "all that you know of this gentleman." "It began 11 or 12 years ago, in Paris. My daughter was a young girl then, full of foolish romantic notions, like all young girls are. Unknown to me, she made the acquaintance of this Comte de la Roche. You've heard of him, perhaps?" The commissary and Poirot nodded in assent. "He calls himself the Comte de la Roche," continued Fanaldin, "but I doubt if he has any right to the title." "You would not have found his name in the Almanach de Gotha," agreed the commissary.
"I discovered as much," said Fanaldin. "The man was a good-looking, plausible scoundrel with a fatal fascination for women. Ruth was infatuated with him, but I soon put a stop to the whole affair. The man was no better than a common swindler."
"You are quite right," said the commissary. "The Comte de la Roche is well known to us. If it were possible, we should have laid him by the heels before now. But, ma foi, it is not easy. The fellow is cunning. His affairs are always conducted with ladies of high social position. If he obtains money from them under false pretenses or as the fruit of blackmail, eh bien, naturally, they will not prosecute. To look foolish in the eyes of the world, oh no, that would never do. And he has an extraordinary power over women."
"This is so," said the millionaire heavily. "Well, as I told you, I broke the affair up pretty sharply. I told Ruth exactly what he was, and she had, perforce, to believe me. About a year afterwards, she met her present husband and married him. As far as I knew, that was the end of the matter. But only a week ago, I discovered, to my amazement, that my daughter had resumed her acquaintance with the Comte de la Roche. She'd been meeting him frequently in London and Paris. I remonstrated with her on her imprudence, for I may tell you, gentlemen, that on my insistence, she was preparing to bring a suit for divorce against her husband."
"That is interesting," murmured Poirot softly, his eyes on the ceiling. Fanaldin looked at him sharply and then went on. "I pointed out to her the folly of continuing to see the Comte under the circumstances. I thought she agreed with me." The examining magistrate coughed delicately. "But according to this letter," he began and then stopped. Fanaldin's jaw set itself squarely. "I know. It's no good mincing matters. However unpleasant, we've got to face facts. It seems clear that Ruth had arranged to go to Paris and meet de la Roche there. After my warnings to her, however,
She must have written to the count suggesting a change of rendezvous. The Ilors, said the commissary thoughtfully, are situated just opposite Hyères, a remote and idyllic spot. Van Alden nodded.
My God, how could Ruth be such a fool? He exclaimed bitterly. All this talk about writing a book on jewels. Why, he must have been after the rubies from the first.
There are some very famous rubies, said Poirot, originally part of the crown jewels of Russia. They are unique in character, and their value is almost fabulous. There has been a rumor that they've lately passed into possession of an American. Are we right in concluding, monsieur, that you were the purchaser?
Yes, said Van Alden. They came into my possession in Paris about 10 days ago.
Pardon me, monsieur, but you've been negotiating for their purchase for some time.
A little over 2 months. Why?
These things become known, said Poirot. There's always a pretty formidable crowd on the track of jewels such as these. A spasm distorted the other's face.
I remember, he said brokenly, a joke I made to Ruth when I gave them to her. I told her not to take them to the Riviera with her, as I could not afford to have her robbed and murdered for the sake of the jewels. My God, the things one says, never dreaming or knowing that they'll come true.
There was a sympathetic silence, and then Poirot spoke in a detached manner. Let us arrange our facts with order and precision. According to our present theory, this is how they run. The Comte de la Roche knows of your purchase of these jewels. By an easy stratagem, he induces Madame Kettering to bring the stones with her. He, then, is the man Mason saw in the train at Paris. The other three nodded in agreement. Madame is surprised to see him, but he deals with the situation promptly. Mason is got out of the way. A dinner basket is ordered. We know from the conductor that he made up the berth for the first compartment, but he did not go into the second compartment, and that a man could quite well have been concealed from him. So far, the Comte could have been hidden to a marvel. No one knows of his presence on the train except Madame. He's been careful that the maid did not see his face. All that she could say is that he was tall and dark. It is almost conveniently vague. They are alone. And the train rushes through the night. There would be no outcry, no struggle, for the man is, so she thinks, her lover. He turned gently to Van Alden. Death, monsieur, must have been almost instantaneous. We will pass over that quickly. The Comte takes the jewel case, which lies ready to his hand. Shortly afterwards, the train draws into Lyon. Monsieur Carrège nodded his approval.
Precisely. The conductor, without, descends. It would be easy for our man to leave the train unseen. It would be easy to catch a train back to Paris or anywhere he pleases. And the crime would be put down as an ordinary train robbery. But for the letter found in Madame's bag, the Comte would not have been mentioned.
It was an oversight on his part not to search that bag, declared the commissary. Without doubt, he thought that he'd destroyed that letter. It was... Pardon me, monsieur. It was an indiscretion of the first water to keep it.
And yet, murmured Poirot, it was an indiscretion the Comte might have foreseen.
You mean... I mean we are all agreed on one point, and that is that the Comte de la Roche knows one subject à fond, women. How was it that, knowing women as he does, he did not foresee that Madame would have kept that letter?
Yes, said the examining magistrate doubtfully. There is something in what you say. But at such times, you understand, a man is not master of himself. He does not reason calmly, mon Dieu, he added with feeling. If our criminals kept their heads and acted with intelligence, how should we capture them?
Poirot smiled to himself.
It seems to me a clear case, said the other, but a difficult one to prove. The Comte is a slippery customer, and unless the maid can identify him, which is most unlikely, said Poirot.
True, true, the examining magistrate rubbed his chin. It is going to be difficult.
If he did indeed commit the crime, began Poirot,
Monsieur Coe interrupted.
If,
You say if? Yes, Monsieur le Commissaire, I say if.
The other looked at him sharply. You're right, he said at last. We go too fast. It is possible that the Comte may have an alibi, that we should look foolish.
Ah, ça par exemple, replied Poirot. That is of no importance whatever.
Naturally, if he committed the crime, he will have an alibi. A man with the Comte's experience does not neglect to take precautions.
No, I said if, for a very definite reason.
And what was that?
Poirot wagged an emphatic forefinger. The psychology.
Eh? Said the commissary.
The psychology is at fault. The Comte is a scoundrel. Yes. The Comte is a swindler. Yes. The Comte preys upon women. Yes. He proposes to steal Madame's jewels. Again, yes.
Is he the kind of man to murder her?
I say no. A man of the type of the Comte is always a coward. He takes no risks. He plays the safe, the mean, what the English call the low-down game.
But murder? 100 times no.
He shook his head in a dissatisfied manner.
The examining magistrate, however, did not seem disposed to agree with him.
The day always comes when such gentry lose their heads and go too far, he observed sagely. Doubtless, that is the case here. Without wishing to disagree with you, Monsieur Poirot.
It was only an opinion, Poirot hastened to explain.
The case is, of course, in your hands, and you will do what seems fit to you.
I'm satisfied in my own mind the Comte de la Roche is the man we need to get hold of, said Monsieur Carrège.
You agree with me, Monsieur le Commissaire?
Perfectly.
And you, Monsieur Van Alden?
Yes, said the millionaire.
Yes, the man is a thorough-paced villain, no doubt about it.
It will be difficult to lay hands on him, I'm afraid, said the magistrate, but we will do our best.
Telegraphed instructions shall go out at once.
Permit me to assist you, said Poirot. There need be no difficulty.
Eh?
The others stared at him. The little man smiled beamingly back at them.
It is my business to know things, he explained. The Comte is a man of intelligence. He's at present at a villa he has leased, the Villa Marina at Antibes.